with medical experts from Mayo Clinic, Johns Hopkins, the Cleveland Clinic, and more, this is Med Clinic Radio.
Med Clinic Radio.
Exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Here's your host, Gina Tedesco.
This week, a look at a large British study that examines the connection between body weight and the risk of severe COVID-19. The lead author of the University of Oxford study will share her eye-opening findings. Then, sarcoma, a form of cancer that begins in the bones and in the soft or connective tissues, is one of the more common types of childhood cancer. On our Mayo Clinic Q&A segment, we'll learn about recent treatment advances. And do you avoid evening workouts? We'll talk with the author of an Australian study that measured how evening exercise affects sleep and appetite. Stay with us for this week's Med Clinic Radio.
Welcome back to Med Clinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
British researchers have found a potential link between body weight and the risk of severe coronavirus, especially for younger adults. Our guest is Dr. Carmen Piernas, University Research Lecturer at the University of Oxford's Nuffield Department of Primary Care Health Sciences. So, Dr. Piernas, you and a team of researchers examined the connection between COVID and obesity. Your findings, published in the Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology, which is a peer-reviewed journal. Tell us a bit about your study.
Well, we have heard a lot about different risk factors that made people have a more severe disease when they were positive for COVID. And being the biggest risk factor of obviously age. So the older we are, a weaker immune system or even chronic diseases made people have a more severe illness. Then we started seeing studies about other risk factors like sex or ethnicity and even obesity emerged quite early in the pandemic. We also had seen quite a large study where they looked at the risk of COVID disease outcomes among people with obesity. And they've already sort of reported much higher risks of severe COVID outcomes in people with obesity. What we wanted to do is to find a much larger sample of people with COVID disease and a measurement of their body weight and to look at across the whole range of weight.
What were the results of your study?
So what we found is among this large sample of 8 million people, we found the lowest risk of COVID severe outcomes was found at a BMI of 23. So BMI is a measurement of our weight in relation to our height. Normally, we would consider our healthy BMI between 18.5 and 25. So the study found the lowest risk of COVID outcomes was at a BMI of 23. We found that even one unit in BMI increase was associated significantly with more severe COVID outcomes. And we also found that below that point, so people with even a healthy BMI or underweight were also having increased risks of a severe COVID outcome. This is what we call in epidemiology a J shape. So there is a level where people in a BMI around 23 have their lowest risk of severe COVID. Above and below that point, we found increased risks of severe COVID outcomes.
The study is interesting on several levels, but it sounds like the key to your findings was dividing the subjects into age groups?
Yeah, that's correct. That was another point of novelty in this study because, again, we had heard a lot about obesity, but obviously there was also a very strong association with age. So we wanted to look at the different groups of age and see if the obesity association was the same. Interestingly, what we found is that the risks associated with excess weight or BMI were a lot higher in the younger age group. In the group of people aged 20 to 39 years old, the risk per each BMI unit increase was 9% for hospital admission. And that risk decreased with age to the point that in people 80 years old or more, we didn't find significant increases in risk of hospital admission or even death.
So, to summarize, you found that the COVID-19 risks for people over age 80 were not really affected by whether they were obese.
That's right. The people of age 80 or more are the people who suffered the most from the COVID disease, especially death. So the majority of deaths have happened in this age group. And what happens is that this age group is more likely to have other issues around, and especially also a weaker immune system. So their absolute risks in this older age group is a lot higher. And that's the reason why obesity really doesn't contribute any excess risk. However, in the younger people, especially in the group of 20 to 39, they are a lot less likely to have any other secondary conditions, and they usually have a better immune system. So in this group of younger people, obesity is a lot more important.
Another interesting finding is that obesity seemed to be separate from obesity-related conditions like diabetes when it comes to the risk of COVID-19, right?
Yes. In our analysis, we tried to adjust for the fact that people with a higher BMI or excess weight are more likely to have conditions, for example, type 2 diabetes. So we wanted to look at the independent effect of BMI excess weight on COVID outcomes, independent of having or not type 2 diabetes. And we still found a very significant association. It means that regardless of your other conditions, such as type 2 diabetes, which is one of the most important ones, every increase in excess weight in BMI is associated significantly with COVID outcomes. And the same happens with type 2 diabetes. People with type 2 diabetes also have a much higher increased risk of COVID outcomes, and that is independent of their BMI.
So when it comes to COVID, is there such a thing as overweight but healthy?
Well, we don't really know that from the study we did, but we know from other studies in other conditions that there is no such thing as a healthy overweight person. And we've done a study in relation to this that is currently under review, which shows that people who adhere to very healthy behaviors, for example, physical activity, healthy diet, alcohol or smoking, the more healthy you try to be in terms of all of these behaviors, the better. But if you have overweight, there's nothing that can save you, because excess fat mass in your body has many, many, many different ways to sort of increase your risk of different conditions. And in this case, COVID is one that is unclear yet why people with excess weight is having this response. Is it a much higher viral load, or is it an increased inflammation in their body that makes them progress more rapidly into a more severe disease? It's all a hypothesis at the moment, but any extra excess weight that you've got puts you at a higher risk of severe COVID outcomes.
We'll continue our conversation with Dr. Carmen Piernas from the University of Oxford to get her advice for healthy younger people concerned about COVID-19 as MedClinic Radio continues.
Let's return to MedClinic Radio with your host, Gina Tedesco.
We're back now with Dr. Carmen Piernas, University Research Lecturer from the Nuffield Department of Primary Care Health Sciences at the University of Oxford. This involves a study of nearly 7 million people living in England to examine the connection between excess weight and COVID-19. Dr. Piernas, what does this study say in terms of the actual risk factor for normal weight people, say, under age 40?
For people of younger age groups who have got a healthy weight, they have the lowest risks of any COVID-related illness or complication. A, because they're young, and B, because they've got a healthy BMI. We also need to think about that age is the strongest risk factor. So just by being young, you are a lot less likely to have a severe COVID-19. Now, that changes within the younger age group. People who've got excess weight are a lot more likely to develop severe COVID or even die from COVID because of their obesity compared to the same healthy weight and young counterparts. At the time we released this, we started doing the group of the under 40s when the study was released. So one of the messages was to prioritize all the young people with obesity, because in reality, the young people are not going to be at very high risk of severe COVID in any case. But if you're overweight, yes, you are. So that was one of the main messages. They should be prioritizing people who were young and had obesity.
In terms of BMI, is there a threshold where you feel like the red light should be flashing? Say, a BMI of 30 or 35. Is there a number that really should get people's attention?
From the study that we've conducted, as I've said, even from the point of a BMI 23, which is a healthy weight, above that point, we start seeing increased risks of severe COVID outcomes, such as hospital admission. For death, that risk goes a bit more towards the BMI around 30. So I would say for COVID death, a BMI of 30 is the sort of like the point where we clearly see much, much increased risks of COVID death. For other diseases, we know a BMI of 30, obesity, is where we see a lot, much higher increased risk, for example, for cardiovascular disease or diabetes. So I would say in terms of a message for the population, any excess weight is not good for anything. What we know from the previous evidence is that people with a BMI of 30, which is considered obesity, is where we start seeing the majority of increased risks for the majority of chronic diseases that affect a lot of the population these days. And for COVID specifically, we see these risks for COVID death above 30. For other COVID-related severe outcomes like hospital admission, we already see that from a much lower BMI, for example, from 23.
And for listeners who may not know their own personal BMI, a 30 BMI would be someone 5 feet 4 inches tall who weighs 175 pounds or more. And for someone 6 feet tall, it's 221 pounds or more. That would be a 30 BMI, what you're saying would be in the danger zone. 23 BMI, that would be a very trim person. What percentage of people out there are in that safe zone of 23 BMI or so?
Actually, very few. In fact, in the UK population, about 70% of people are above that. So the majority of people are in the highest risk. So there is a minority that are in the underweight category, and also a minority which are in that sort of like 20 to 23, 24 BMI, and then 70% is above that.
Based on your findings, do you think a global campaign highlighting the risk of COVID-19 to those who are obese might be a responsible step for authorities to take? Perhaps other than vaccination, weight loss might be the best step for most of us to take to protect ourselves?
Of course it is, but I think we've heard enough about how obesity increases risk of COVID or these other diseases. What we need is governments and policymakers helping these people achieve and maintain a healthy weight. So we should stop blaming people for their obesity. We need to help them. We know obesity is bad for everything. We just need to make it easier for everybody to achieve and maintain a healthy weight. And that's where we need more investment and better policies. In the UK, our own Prime Minister here recognized, he even said that his severe COVID disease was likely due to his overweight. And even around the summer last year, and it's been confirmed during this year, the government will be releasing new policies to, for example, limit advertisements on junk food on television, as well as restrictions in the way food specifically junk food is marketed in retail settings. So I think they're doing some steps forward, but we need a lot more. Because as I said, if 70% of people are at a BMI that puts them at risk of severe COVID outcomes, we need to do something about that. And we need to do it soon. COVID one day hopefully will be controlled with vaccines, but chronic disease like cardiovascular disease or diabetes, even cancer is related to obesity. We're not going to fix that anytime soon. We need huge investment and a lot of help to curb this trend.
As you mentioned earlier in this interview, this became apparent fairly early on in the pandemic. Why do you suppose so little attention has been given in the public messaging to obesity versus all the other attempts to slow down the pandemic?
Well, I suppose there were other priorities. You know, people were suffering. This is a new threat for everybody across the world. And the main focus was on controlling the virus. In fact, the measurements that put in place to control the virus are actually not going to help with obesity at all, with lockdowns restricting movement.
Gyms closed.
Exactly. People around their houses a lot more, very little to do other than, for example, the pleasure of eating, perhaps for many people. So I think that hasn't really helped. And it wasn't really their priority when the main priority was to control the virus. But as we move on to the next phase of hopefully controlling the virus, we need to put this message out there, but not blaming the people who've got obesity, and just help them and help everybody. We're all at risk as we all age. We're all more likely to put on weight, and it's really hard to lose weight. It's not a very easy thing to do. That's why we've got this problem. It's not a really easy thing to do, but it's modifiable. That is the other important message. There are things that put you at higher risk of COVID, for example, which is age to begin with. And some studies have found sex as well as ethnicity. You can't change those things. Your weight, you can change it. So we just need to find ways to help everybody to achieve that.
And I understand your research in the area is ongoing. Tell us what's next up.
We're currently starting a study about vaccine effectiveness, because there is some evidence from the US. Actually, I studied at UNC Chapel Hill, and there are people there who had done studies like 10 years ago showing how the flu vaccines were less effective in people with obesity. So what we are trying to do now is using the very large data on vaccinations in the UK and seeing if people who have obesity are, for example, more likely to get infected after vaccine than people without obesity, because there is, as I said, evidence from the flu that after the vaccine, they may not develop an adequate immune response, or at least the same immune response. And there might be other pathways, for example, inflammation related or other biological pathways that make them not respond equally to the vaccines. So we're actually only starting it now. So this is going to take a few months from now on the vaccine effectiveness.
Dr. Carmen Piernas from the University of Oxford, thank you for joining us and good luck in your future research.
Thank you so much.
Up next, cancer is the leading disease-related cause of death in children. On this week's Mayo Clinic Q&A segment, a look at a recent treatment advance for one of the more common types of childhood cancer as MedClinic Radio continues.
With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minute, I'm Ian Roth. Epilepsy can be a jarring condition, and it's more common than you probably think.
Epilepsy can affect anyone at any age.
In fact, neurologist Dr. Joseph Servin says one out of every 26 Americans has a risk of developing epilepsy.
Every brain has a potential to have a seizure. It just depends on what the circumstances are and what are the conditions around it that may lead to a seizure or epilepsy in some people.
Dr. Servin says some people are born with epilepsy, while others develop it from head trauma, certain infections, brain tumors, stroke, even Alzheimer's disease. Most epilepsy patients can control their seizures with medication. Others, with more severe cases, may require surgery. But in some cases where surgery isn't possible, doctors can implant a device similar to a pacemaker for the heart that can control seizures. Dr. Servin says there are also some simple things you can do to lower your risk.
Avoid alcohol, get plenty of sleep, and then thirdly, find ways to manage stress.
For more information, talk with your healthcare provider or visit mayoclinic.org.
You're listening to MedClinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
One in every 266 children and adolescents will be diagnosed with cancer by age 20, according to the American Cancer Society. This week's Mayo Clinic Q&A segment focuses on one of the more common types of childhood cancer. Here's Joel Streed.
According to the American Cancer Society, cancer is the second leading cause of death in children. Now, fortunately, recent treatment advances have increased survival rates. 84% of children with cancer now survive 5 years or more. Sarcoma, a term for a group of cancers that begin in the bones and in the soft tissues and connective tissues, is one of the more common types of childhood cancer. And joining us to discuss sarcoma is Mayo Clinic hematologist-oncologist, Dr. Wendy Allen Rhodes. Let's start simple. Many of us have heard the terms osteosarcoma and Ewing sarcoma. Can you explain just what sarcoma is and the different types, and are these the same disease?
Sure. Sarcomas are a group of cancers that happen in children and in adults, and there are several hundred different types of sarcomas, but the two that you just named, osteosarcoma, Ewing sarcoma, are two of the most common. The other common one is rhabdomyosarcoma. And even though they're in the same category or family of tumors, they're very different and they're treated differently. So osteosarcoma and Ewing sarcoma are both bone sarcomas, and they're treated generally with chemotherapy, surgery, sometimes radiation, but the types of chemotherapy we use are different. So it's very important for us as a team to know exactly which type of sarcoma is diagnosed in a child so that we can come up with the right treatment plan.
Do we know what causes sarcoma?
Sometimes we do and sometimes we don't. One of the main differences of all childhood cancers is even though we're learning more and more about what causes them, they're not what we consider modifiable risk factors. So most of the time in childhood cancer and in sarcomas in children and adolescents, it's just a mistake that happens as a child or an adolescent is growing and developing. And it's not necessarily from, you know, exposure to a certain agent like cigarette smoke or tobacco, those sorts of things. So we know the genetic changes that happen in the cells, but we don't know why some children get those genetic changes in their cells as they grow and others don't. But for some children and for some families that have a family history of cancer, we do know what the ultimate genetic cause is and we can start screening them early. But that is a really, really small percentage of patients that that happens to.
Are there signs and symptoms of the disease?
Yeah, most children and adolescents do present with clinical signs and symptoms. So it depends on where the tumor develops. So sarcomas can develop in any place in the body. The most common places are in the muscles or the bones. So sometimes people will present with a mass or a lump or a bump that they can feel that wasn't there before. Other times they present with pain. Oftentimes, if it's a bone cancer, people will come in and say that their child is waking up at night and complaining of bone pain. And that is something that we're always concerned about. So most of the time, there is something that brings them to the pediatrician's attention. Usually it's the parents. Let's be honest, parents are always the best observers of their children. But it's not uncommon because there are so many things that look like bone pain, like growing pains and things like that in children, that there can be quite a delay to diagnosis in children because cancer overall is pretty rare in children and adolescents. So it can take some time to get to the right diagnosis.
How do we diagnose this disease?
Most time people will come in with, you know, a symptom, whether it's pain, a lump or a bump, et cetera. The next thing that we usually do is get some type of imaging, whether it be an X-ray, an ultrasound, an MRI. And based on that imaging, we can often get an idea of whether we think that this is something that we need to work up further or not. Most of the time, just looking at the imaging, we can tell that it needs more workup. We need either advanced imaging or something like that. And then really to ultimately diagnose any type of cancer, we have to get a biopsy. And a biopsy is a small piece of tissue where we sample it. We send it to our pathologists here at Mayo Clinic, and they look at it under the microscope. They tell us what it looks like. They do genetic testing on it and all sorts of special stains. And then they come to a conclusion what the diagnosis is. So it's really, really important that the very first step, the diagnosis and the histology or what the tumor looks like under the microscope is correct because everything else falls in line after that because I have to know what it is so that we can come up with a treatment plan to cure it.
Do you follow the general rules of, you know, looking at stage and type and things like that as other cancers?
It's a little bit different than what somebody might be familiar with for, say, colon cancer or breast cancer. For sarcomas, it's usually what we call localized, which means that it just stays in the place where it started, or metastatic. So it doesn't sort of go through the stage 1, 2, 3, 4 like people might be used to with breast cancer or prostate cancer, things like that. And so we either call them localized, meaning it just stays in that one place where it started, or metastatic, meaning we see it in other areas of the body that it's spread to. There are some nuances to that, but that's the general scheme of how we do it. And that is a very common question I get when people come in is what is the stage of cancer that I have? And it's a little bit different than adult cancer staging.
Treatment options. What can we do for this now?
Sarcomas can be treated in three ways, and cancers can be treated in three main ways. We can cut them out with surgery. We can use chemotherapy, which is a bucket term for any medication that we use to get the cancer cells to die, or we can use radiation therapy. For sarcomas, depending on what type of sarcoma it is, we might use one, two or all three of those options, and just depends on what type it is and where it's at. But most people will need a combination of at least chemotherapy and surgery together. That's the most common plan that we come up with.
Is there a role for proton beam in treating sarcoma in children?
Yeah, absolutely. So proton beam therapy is a type of radiation therapy, and it's a very specialized type of radiation therapy. So radiation therapy works very well for sarcomas. It is basically high energy X-rays that are aimed at the tumor to kill the tumor cells. And the difference between sort of regular conventional radiation and proton therapy radiation is that our radiation oncologists are able to contour a little bit tighter with proton therapy, and therefore the surrounding tissue that is normal, that is not tumor, is spared from some of the side effects. And this is really important in children who are growing, because we want them to be able to grow normally and not have, you know, discrepancy in the length of their legs or have their bones not grow as long as the other side. And also just for teenagers who may be done growing, there is a risk to radiation that secondary cancers can develop. And if you're 18 and you're going to live to be 80, there's a long period of time where that second cancer could develop, and we want to minimize that. And so proton therapy has been very beneficial for all of our younger patients, even if they're already done growing, just to spare that normal tissue damage.
How successful are we with treatment? What is the survival rate for pediatric sarcoma?
So pediatric sarcoma, the overall survival rate, if you sort of lump everything together and make some big generalizations, is probably about 65 to 70% of children and adolescents that are diagnosed with sarcomas are alive at 5 years from their diagnosis. Most of the patients that we diagnose have localized disease, which we talked about earlier, is where it just stays in one place. When it's spread to other areas of the body, that is where we really still have a very difficult time treating them. And that is where the main areas of research are taking place right now, is how do we treat those children and adolescents better who already have metastatic disease, because their outcomes are very, very poor compared to patients who have localized disease and to other childhood cancers in general. So we really feel in the sarcoma community that we have a lot of work to do, because 65 to 75% is not enough for us. And those metastatic patients, we certainly feel like there is an urgent need for us to do better and have higher cure rates for them. So we still have a ways to go, but we're doing much, much better than we were, you know, 20, 30 years ago. But until we can cure everyone, it will never be enough.
If a family gets this unfortunate diagnosis, what should they look for in a provider? Experience? Are there certain credentials for a facility that they should be aware of?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. You know, a lot of people, obviously a cancer diagnosis is very anxiety provoking. There's a lot of fear surrounding it. And when you're dealing with rare tumors, there's a lot of uncertainty. So in the pediatric oncology world, we're pretty blessed that we work across the nation in a big consortium. We're all part of one consortium. But it is really important that the diagnosis is correct. And that starts with having the tissue or the biopsy looked at by a pathologist who has a lot of experience in looking at sarcoma samples. As I said, there's hundreds of different types of sarcomas, and all of them can happen in children. And so it's really imperative that the diagnosis is correct. And then the other really important thing is, if surgery is needed, if surgery is part of the treatment plan, you really need a good surgeon who knows how to do sarcoma-specific surgeries and understands the disease sort of from beginning to end and what the therapy looks like. And then lastly, you know, for people like me, the oncologist, the chemotherapy is pretty standardized across the country. And so we've done a good job of standardizing that, but getting that whole team together might mean that it's all in one place, like here at Mayo Clinic and other larger academic centers. We're sort of all under one roof. But if they're out in more rural areas or away from a sarcoma center, it might mean that they come here for proton therapy and go back home for chemotherapy and sort of put that team together across state lines or virtually. And that's okay, but you want to make sure that each of those people know exactly what to do with sarcoma so that the team can be comprehensive in the sarcoma care.
What's on the horizon? Where is research leading us in this area right now?
Sarcomas have been a tough nut to crack, for sure, in terms of research and novel innovative therapies. we had a lot of hope for immunotherapy, you know, as that was sort of hitting the horizon and we were getting a lot of success stories with childhood leukemia. But sarcomas have been pretty resistant to immunotherapy, but there are a lot of very smart people who are still trying to tweak those types of gene therapies, T cell therapies, et cetera, to make that work. So that is still ongoing, but there's still a lot of work to do. I think we're becoming smarter with our surgeries. We're becoming smarter with the way that we radiate things, like we talked about with proton therapy, intra-op therapy, et cetera. But there are still years and years to go before we are going to get to the point where we need it to be. We recently, probably a year and a half ago, have the first new agent for a type of sarcoma that has a specific gene mutation or fusion in it that used to be very chemo resistant that now has a 97% response rate. So there are these small wins out there. We want more, obviously. But I think that is coming as we learn more about the genetics of the tumors and what is making them happen and developing specific drugs for those specific changes. So we are getting there and we are working on it, but we wanted it yesterday for sure.
As we mentioned, this is Childhood Cancer Awareness Month. Why is that important?
Yeah, you know, I think people, until it happens to somebody you know or happens to your own child, people don't think that children develop cancer. I think people often think that children can't tolerate the therapy that would be needed to cure their cancer. And they don't know that over 85% of our children now, you know, taking sarcomas out of it, but putting it into the bigger bucket, if we look at all childhood cancer, we have very high cure rates. And we've done a really good job as a community, a research community, to develop these therapies. But that being said, we still are lacking in funding for research. A lot of people still don't know what to do if a child is diagnosed with cancer, where to go, et cetera. And so we just want people to know that, you know, we know that a cancer diagnosis is scary. We know that it's life altering, but we want you to know that there's hope, that we are doing really good things here at Mayo Clinic and abroad. And there is hope for cure and there is life after childhood cancer. So even though only about 16,000 children are diagnosed with a new cancer each year, the risk of having a cancer develop between the ages of 0 and 21 is actually not that low because, you know, there's 21 years in there. And so we just want the world to know that we can treat this. There is hope, but we still need to push that research and we still need to support our scientists so that the therapies that I give 20 years from now are not the same ones that I'm giving today. We want to do better. We want to cure them better. We want to cure them with less damage and make sure that they're able to go on to live the lives that they want to live.
Sounds like a excellent goal to have for the future.
Yes.
Is there anything else you'd like, anything else you'd like to add in this area today?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, I think just having people's awareness, if somebody that you know has a child who has been diagnosed with cancer, it takes a village to get the family and the child through that diagnosis. So be there, support them in any way that you can. And just wrap your arms around those people in your lives that are going through this because it is challenging. You know, we are excited for the future and we're happy that we're able to provide the care that we do.
Well, our thanks to Mayo Clinic hematologist-oncologist Dr. Wendy Allen Rhodes for joining us to discuss sarcoma.
You can find Mayo Clinic Q&A wherever you find your favorite podcasts or visit newsnetwork.mayoclinic.org and then click on podcasts to see previous shows. In our next segment, are you reluctant to hit the gym at night because you think it will keep you tossing and turning all night? We'll talk to the author of an Australian study that examined that popular belief, and we'll have the results next as MedClinic Radio continues in a moment.
Welcome back to MedClinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
Are you afraid of evening exercise? It's a popular belief that hitting the gym at night may keep you tossing and turning all night. Penny Larson from the Charles Stewart University School of Exercise, Science, Sport, and Health in Australia is the lead author of a study that examined this question. So Penny, tell us, what's the big headline from your study?
We found that early evening high-intensity exercise did not disrupt sleep, and evening exercise also had a greater impact on reducing ghrelin, which is the hunger hormone.
When you're describing exercise in the evening, this is not simply going out for a walk after dinner, is it? This is fairly high-intensity exercise, right?
Yes, exactly. So the participants performed a 30-minute high-intensity protocol, which involved 6 1-minute maximal efforts on a bike, and then they had 4 minutes of passive rest in between those sprints.
And these study subjects were middle-aged men?
Yes, so they ranged from 35 to 60, but I think our mean was about 44 years of age.
Did they work out before dinner or afterwards?
It was before. So we did ask them to fast for 2 hours prior to participating in the exercise. And this was for the appetite variables that we were measuring.
You mentioned it a moment ago, but talk about how these evening workouts affected their appetites.
Sure. So with the afternoon and the evening trial, we asked participants to fast for 2 hours, and we found that pre-exercise, acylated ghrelin was slightly elevated for both the afternoon and the evening trial, which may have to do with the circadian rhythm of that hormone. But then post-exercise, we saw a significant decline in ghrelin, which would suggest reductions in perceived hunger.
So it sounds like if someone wanted to use exercise as a part of a weight loss program, maybe working out in the evening is a better idea?
Possibly. Anecdotally, participants did say that they ate less. We didn't see it in the recorded diaries that we had, but they did say they were less hungry. Basically, their focus was on recovery, not so much on eating.
I understand you also found differences in the various times of day in the person's strength or power?
Yes. So it was an aerobic high-intensity protocol. So they were on a stationary bike. And we found that their sprint power outputs were higher compared to the morning exercise trial. So it appears that they were able to put in more effort in the afternoon and the evening. So whether this had to do with a preference of being a morning person versus an evening person, or whether there's actually something physiologically going on, would need further investigation.
So your study found that working out did not negatively impact sleep. How soon after exercise did your subjects get to bed?
So it was around normal bedtime for them, which was about 10:30 p.m. Some participants did go to bed a little bit later. So exercise was performed about 3 hours on average prior to sleep onset.
Do you have an opinion about how late in the evening may be too late for exercise?
Obviously, it's going to be different for different people, but I personally would suggest that so long as the exercise isn't actually impacting your sleep duration, so long as you're not cutting off your sleep for the purpose of exercising, then it shouldn't negatively impact your sleep. Whereas if you're enforcing a shorter sleep duration, then that's going to have other effects on the subsequent days, and if it's prolonged, obviously the weeks and months there as well. But I would also suggest the same for the morning. So you're not getting up earlier than you normally would for the purpose of exercising, but it becomes your normal routine.
What's next in your research?
I would like to do a similar study with female participants, just because there's a lot of hormonal differences between males and females, which may show different responses with sleep and appetite as well, particularly throughout different months and different cycles for women. And then also turning it into a long-term study as well. So we only looked at a single bout of exercise for the morning, the afternoon, and the evening. However, it would be interesting to see whether long-term effects either change anything, or to actually see the weight management benefits of exercising at different times of day.
Penny Larson, PhD candidate from the Charles University School of Exercise, Science, Sport, and Health in Australia. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for this week's Med Clinic Radio, a production of Syndication Networks of Chicago. Our executive producer is Randy Meyer, and I'm Gina Tedesco. Thanks for listening, and we hope you join us again next week for another edition of Med Clinic Radio. Syndication Networks.